doing in those trousers? Stop it, whatever it is. Look at you, lily-livered mincer. You know, I was in the war, but I didn't see you there. I fought for people like you, and I never got one.
Definitely a thematic thing on the first side about travelling. But I didn't want to make too much of a thing about that and call it Travel Along with Bowie or something. So I thought Lodger was sort of, you know, casually covered it all.
It was originally going to be called Your Fucking Anger.
There was a point where it was going to be called that. It was also going to be called Planned Accidents. And just before that, it was going to be called Despite Straight Lines, which all went out the window. Planned Accidents, yeah. I think that's what we'll probably use as an instrumental album. I think Brian and I might get together on something just called Planned Accidents. Maybe just the two of us. I don't know.
Hello, and welcome to Album with me, Arslan Mohammed. And I am happy that you've joined me for what could well be an adequately amusing 40 minutes or so quality Bowie bounce. So here we are, it's mid-April here in lockdown London, and I'm hoping that you're listening to me in good health, reasonable sanity. And I also want to shout out to all the listeners in the future. Thanks guys, I don't know how you did it, but you made it through. Alright, so anyway, in this edition, well, I was going to begin this podcast with some sort of smart-ass intro like, what do Pink Floyd, The Smiths, Robert Palmer, David Coverdale, McFly all have in common? But given that you've seen the title of this episode, you'll probably already know that, so I'll just mention the fact that not only has bass player extraordinaire Guy Pratt enjoyed one of the most colourful careers in the rock and roll biz, but he survived to tell the tale in a superb book, My Bass and Other Animals, which is one of my favourite music books and is thoroughly recommended, especially if you want some laughs and quality anecdotes to tide you over this lockdown period. So, I was delighted when Guy agreed to join me on the podcast, as he is a born raconteur, and actually he's been touring a stand-up show based on the stories in his book, as well as throwing in many more which didn't make the final cut. He's also playing with Nick Mason's Saucerful of Secrets, the Pink Floyd drummer's touring extravaganza that revisits the era of Syd Barrett and the early 1970s in the band's history. So, when we spoke, Guy, like all of us, was at home, rather than performing with the band who were actually meant to be playing the UK around now. But hopefully they'll be rescheduling those live dates, so if you're a Floydian, a Syd head, or just love a big psychedelic rock and roll circus, keep an ear out for that. Of course, Bowie himself was a lifelong Syd Barrett fan, and it was actually at his final UK appearance with Dave Gilmour at the Albert Hall in 2006 that he shared a stage with Guy for that haunting performance of Arnold Lane and Comfortably Numb. So playing bass with Bowie is just one of the experiences we're going to be hearing about in this series of conversations with Guy, as well as his filling in for Gail Ann Dorsey, pissing off former members of the Smiths, introducing his mum to Bowie, staying healthy on tour in Australia, and being escorted from a transatlantic flight in a hog-whimpering, semi-comatose stupor, thanks to Jimmy Page. The album that we begin to discuss, and to be honest, we don't get that far into it in this first episode, is Lodger. Definitely a fine and much maligned record that actually offers up a hell of a lot to chew over. And we'll be chewing like anything as we get further into the podcast. Definitely in this episode we start, and then we take another few healthy bites in the next edition. But for now, please do join me and Guy as we meet up over the internet and talk, amongst many, many other things, Lodger. When you write a book like this, do you kind of clear stories with people before you put them in?
Yeah, and I did with the people I mean, you can kind of see, it's quite, from reading the book, you can tell who I want to have dinner with again. And there are some people, I mean, but I found this when I was doing my stand-up show, when people came to the show. It's kind of, because when I did my second version of the show, because David Gilmour was always a great supporter of my show. And you know, I used to poke fun at him a bit in it. And when I did my second version of the show and he came to the opening, and I'd actually thought by then, you know what, David's kind of, he's one of my absolute best friends. It's a bit uncool, really. I shouldn't. So in my second show, I didn't mention him at all. And he came and he was clearly upset.
Oh, really?
There are some things, I mean, it's, it's, you know, the old Oscar Wilde, there's only one thing worse than being talked about, and that's being talked about. But it's, I mean, like, for instance, with Madonna, it's like, she was never going to call me again. And, you know, I mean, there's some people, like, with David Coverdale, where everything I say about him is, I'm poking fun, but it's so clearly affectionate, you know. I mean, I love the guy. The thing that's really interesting for me about the book, also, the thing is that I've since, I stopped drinking about a year ago, and I kind of see all that stuff through a very different lens now. It's like, well, this is clearly someone who's clearly on a journey to becoming a fully fledged alcoholic. And
well, after reading about you and Jimmy Page on the plane, then
him, because obviously, you know, he's such a scary character, although not, I always found him to be a pussycat, but he's, I, everything I wrote about him, I sent to him and said, are you cool with this? You know, I mean, I was willing to take anything out, but he just never got back to me, you know, which is a classic Jimmy. It's like, all right, we'll sod it.
Yeah.
But then some people just like to be upset with you anyway. What is interesting though, is when I ever flick through the book, I find that what's extraordinary is how much of that stuff I remember, which I just go, fuck, if I wrote that now, there's no way I'd remember that. Yeah. And it's almost as if my memory was holding on to it, was holding on to all this stuff until I could get it down. And then it was like, okay, I don't need it anymore.
That's it. You've cleared out the memory banks.
It's all down on paper. Once you've backed it up, once it's all been put on an external drive, you don't have to worry about it. And it's because, and what was, I always used to find funny was when people used to, like the Jimmy Page story, for instance. Because, and it was interesting, did you watch the quiz?
Yes, I did.
Right, there was a really brilliant point that came up during the court case of that, when the barrister says the thing of how memory is not a memory of events, it's a memory of the last time you told it.
Yes.
I suffered from this so much with my stand-up show. It got to sort of like the Jimmy Page story and the Michael Jackson story, where I told the story so many times that all I can remember is the story. And it got to the point where I began up on stage going, I have no idea whether any of this ever fucking happened. All I can remember is the story. So it was great. I remember once Ross Halfin came up to me backstage at a gig, the photographer, and he said, oh, you're on the water then, eh? I said, yeah. He said, last time I saw you, you were being wheeled off a plane in a wheelchair. I was? Thank Christ. So it did happen then.
It really happened. It is true.
I mean, it's true. It's like the Michael Jackson hiding under the desk. I'm just like, did he? What, did that happen? I don't even know that. Did that happen? I, you know.
Bless him, Michael Jackson. I've read other accounts of people who worked with him, and similar stories there again.
Oh, no,
you'd
but
be hiding under the desk.
At that period, he was hiding all the time. Yeah, Nile Rodgers went for a meeting with him, and he was clearly hiding under the desk, and Nile just sat there until it was so awkward, he just had to leave.
But do you think there'll be another instalment of your memoirs? I mean, clearly...
I'd like there to be. I mean, it would be through... I mean, I did start writing one. I mean, I've probably got enough stories. I don't enjoy writing. You know, I don't really like my writing. I tend to use the same sentence structure over and over again. And I use way too much literally, basically, ultimately. I'm reasonably articulate. And my articulacy doesn't seem to translate to my writing as much as I'd like it to.
I thought you've got a very distinct voice, and like you say, your sentence structures and your pacing is wonderful. I can see why you enjoy stand-up. You know, you can tell a story, you can hit those beats perfectly. I mean, I read in an interview you saying this, that you're not so fond of your writing, and then I read your book. And I thought either it's been very heavily edited, or he's an absolutely fine writer.
Oh, thank you. To me, it feels like it's like having to play a bass with only two strings. You've got so much of your arsenal taken away. You don't have timing. You don't have inflection. You don't have... That's why people like, you know, Morrissey's probably a bad example, because actually maybe he was never being ironic, because the whole thing is any sort of sarcasm or irony has to be so telegraphed when you put it on the page, because you just haven't got the inflection. I used to think, I'd like, yes, Morrissey's getting terrible trouble for that. But of course, now you realise, actually, no, maybe not. He was actually just a fascist thug all along.
I think I first ever heard your name when I was a massive Smiths fan. So Andy Rourke was fired. You came on board to... Who was that other guitarist that they had?
Oh, Craig Gannon.
Craig Gannon, only, that was it, yeah.
The only threat of legal action I had over my book was because I described him in the book as a sweet but simple lad who would later freak out on the road.
Yes, right? Yes.
And that's the thing where my publishers get a letter which is written in legalese, written like, you know, and it was like, imagine the distress caused to Craig Gannon and his family. It's like, yeah, because his granny was just running out to buy my book. And But the funny thing, but it's written like this heavy legal letter, but it's from sort of cgannon67@hotmail.com. But my publishers, they took everything very seriously. And they were really freaked out about it. They got, so Guy, look, you know, I think we're going to have to pull him from the book. I was going, well, it doesn't matter. I mean, it's literally a sentence. And I've got nothing against the guy. I'm not trying to be slanderous or anything. But I thought, well, what should I do? And I thought, I know. I'll call Johnny Marr.
Right.
Johnny always knows what to do. So I called Johnny and it was brilliant. And it was, and I said, no, Johnny, I don't know what to do about this. He went, Guy, I don't know. Let me, that's right. I said, I'm just trying on some boots. Let me call you back in half an hour. Which I thought was
Johnny Marr.
So Johnny Marr, right?
Yeah.
And so he called back in half an hour, obviously wearing a fabulous pair of boots. And he says, Guy, look, I thought about it. And I know for a fact that I have called Craig Gannon in print a stupid fucking bastard and a drunken fucking idiot. I think it's the sweet bit he doesn't like.
Take that bit out, you'll be fine.
Yeah, exactly.
That's when I first heard of you, was doing that, and just thinking, Andy Rourke, I think, is a fucking great bass player.
He's a brilliant bass player. It was amazing. Like, he was there when I went down to rehearse with him. He was there. He was.
And you said he seemed all right about it. He didn't seem particularly upset or anything.
He was totally cool.
Yeah,
it was a very funny vibe. But I didn't really, like I said, I was just off my head all the time. I, you know, who cared? But the bass lines were brilliant. I was really, because it was one of those things. Smith songs aren't like you. Johnny's very similar to Gary Kemp's got a similar thing with his songwriting. You hear these songs and you think that's a song. It's a standard. It's got a verse, it's bridge, chorus, and a middle eight. And it hasn't. It's so funny, right? Johnny will be showing you kind of reel around the fountain or something. He goes, right, so you got the intro, and there's this bit, it's the first verse, right? But it's not the same. But then you've got the second, that's not the same as the first verse. Then it does a reintro, but it's not quite the same as the intro. It's another intro. Then there's the chorus. Then it goes back into the intro, but it's not the same as the other intro. And then it's the verse, but the verse isn't the same as the other verse. And then it's, and every bit is slightly different. It's so complicated.
I think it's funny you mentioned that. That is one of my all-time favourite Smith songs.
When I first met Johnny, when I first heard him play guitar, right, and which was just like, what the fuck? What the fuck is going on? Where's the other guy? You know, and
you brought me to the studio, didn't you?
Brian brought him into the studio.
Money changes everything.
Yeah. But what was amazing was I was just thinking, my God, this is some of the best high life guitar playing I've ever had. Heard he? I mean, he had thumb pick and all finger picks, and it's all this ding 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 ding. It's like sounded like it could have been in Fela Kuti's band.
Yeah.
And when I said that, I went, "Man, you must obviously listen to a lot of African music." I had no idea. But it's very, very interesting how people's influences aren't necessarily what they think they are.
Oh right.
The way you play isn't that you don't hear stuff and go, "Yeah, that's what I want to be," and play like that. If you've got musical talent, innate musical talent, then you will play in a certain way. And what you think you are isn't necessarily what you are.
As far as I knew, he grew up around punk, around New Wave. But before that, he was Rory Gallagher, Keith Richards.
That's right,
You know, blues rock, wasn't he? That was his thing. But then when you hear those arpeggios and the way he does his finger picking, you think of Nick Drake, Burt Jansch, and that shimmering tone he gets as well. Ugh.
Yeah, but that's the funny thing. Him and David Gilmour are basically two sides of the same coin in that they're both an orchestra. When Johnny came to see Pink Floyd in Manchester and I introduced Johnny to David, and I was thinking, oh, fuck, this is, you know, because, you know, Johnny's going to be fucking boring or fart and David's going to be, who's this young punk? And that was it. I just sat there complete gooseberry for the whole night.
Yeah.
Couldn't get a word in. You know, they just were like, yeah. You know, it was so sweet.
Totally, yeah.
And thanks to me, it's both of them together on a Kirsty MacColl song.
Really? Which one?
On Kite. I think it's the one about waving or drowning. But yeah, but if you, the guitar credit is David Gilmour and Johnny Marr. It's like, fucking hell. Yeah.
Look at you bringing the legends together.
Yeah, yes.
I love that story about when you met Brian Ferry and he said, hello, I'm Brian Ferry.
Yeah.
Because I interviewed him.
No shit, Sherlock.
Fucking hell, I thought you were Big Daddy.
But he's also got the thing of actually being tall, because they're never tall. Your first thought is always, you think of those, blimey, I thought you'd be taller. It's like, I can't, the amount of times I've said that in my head. Yeah. Blimey, I thought you'd be taller.
What is it with rock stars? Do you think it's a height thing that they...
Well, it's like actors. Movie stars are all tiny.
Yeah.
They're all tiny with big heads, because that's what looks best on the screen. It's what looks best on the screen. They all have outsized heads, apparently.
I never noticed that.
Trivia fans.
Have you ever been in a film? Have you ever had a big part?
I've had loads of bit parts because when I was doing music for TV in the 90s, I always used to ask for a sort of Hitchcockian.
No, walk on.
Yeah, walk on. So I did. I was Minty in Spaced, the guy who sold Socialist Worker.
Oh, and, okay.
Yeah, then won the lottery and had to spend all the money on new knees. I was Pissed Crap Shag in Linda Green. I played a sort of Noel Gallagher character in Still Crazy, where I just had to walk through with this lovely bit.
Oh, that's the one with Bill Nye, girl. Right?
That's the film that made Bill Nye. That's
oh,
kind
wow,
of,
okay, yeah.
When, and he sang it. You know, it was me and Gary Kemp were in charge of the music. And we had this singer and everything. Bill Nye came in and sang like he'd been, you know, like he'd done it his whole life. It was amazing. And that, what else? I was in a film last year, a thing called Burning Men, which is actually really, really quite good. I'd love to be an actor, but I'm not very good at it. I'm only good if I've written it.
When
I'm
it
really
the,
bad.
The Hitchcock walk-on, then you can. You
I'm
can
great for that. I was. Oh yeah, yeah, Young Person's Guide to Becoming a Rock Star. I was an A&R man. I enjoyed
was
that.
That
was a brilliant, brilliant, really big budget series in the 90s about this young Scottish band. If you can find, it's so funny. And I was in charge of all the music. It's really, and it had great guest spots from Chrissie Hynde, Noel Gallagher. Also, Keith Allen was in it. It was really, really good. Big budget thing. Huge hit in Australia, funnily enough. Huh. But it's and in fact, and I got Album of the Week and Melody Maker for it. And it was great because it was right in the middle of Britpop and everything. And I had to invent this kind of 90s band. It was really good fun.
So, you just reminded me, actually, I didn't realise that you were part of Fat Les. Of course, having read the book now, you were pretty much the instigator of Fat Les.
No, I wasn't. It was basically... it was me who came up with the idea of making the chorus Vindaloo. It was just the last line of a verse. That was basically, I think it was Keith's 43rd birthday or something, and a load of them went off in a limo to see Fulham play in a cup match and came back with this idea. And it's when we were all living in the Groucho. And I had the studio at home, and everyone just piled round my house, and off we went.
And that
was hilarious. Yeah.
Amazing. Because I read about it in Alex James's book.
Yeah, he doesn't mention me. He doesn't fucking mention me.
That's why I did a double take when I read
extraordinary.
Your book.
All three of us put out autobiographies at a similar time. And I'm only in two of them. Yeah, Keith gave me a shout. But you know.
Yeah, Alex doesn't mention you at all.
No, he's like, well, you can't have too many names, but you know, Tory cheese wanker. So
Bowie explores a new quality of life as The Lodger on RCA Records.
Why Lodger?
Well, it's probably quite far down the list, isn't it? Let's be honest. And it's because it's not really an album I knew that well, to be honest. But there is something interesting. It's a bridge, really, isn't it? There's this thing of it's the end of the Berlin trilogy, even though it isn't. Well, I suppose it is because it's the last Eno and Fripp one, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
And it has that sound to it.
I don't know if you've heard anything about this, but I read in a couple of places that Eno and Bowie pretty much fell out.
Yeah, I got that impression.
After doing that, because Eno was really in charge of Lodger.
Yeah, so yeah. No, I can imagine of 15, like, really oblique strategies again.
Really, Brian? Yeah. Can we just have some fucking straightforward strategies now, please?
Yeah. The track I always wrongly assumed was interesting. That's not on this album that belongs on it is Fashion. I always thought Fashion was on this album. It sounds like it was recorded in the same session as Boys Keep Swinging. Lyrically, it's exactly that same school of irony. I've always found it hard to describe. There's that brilliant thing that Bowie does that when he does that sort of cold ironic thing of, you know, you get a girl, and I guess it's kind of like it's like Paul Verhoeven, like with Starship Troopers or something. It's, do you know,
that's that a comparison same? I've not heard before.
Yeah. Well, it's a great, because it's with, you know, because Verhoeven's a genius like that. You can take it either way. You can either go with the fascists or see what's really going on, you know. But I always thought, so Boys Keep Swinging. Here's the right thing that really interests me about that song is that apparently they changed instruments, right? And that's Carlos Alomar playing bass. Now, that is the most George Murray bass line I've ever heard in my life, but it doesn't sound like him. If I can get sort of bass player and techie-ish for a bit, because George had a very distinctive sound. I don't know what George used to play. I don't know anything about his equipment, but that bass sounds like it was played on a Music Man with a pick. And it's very, so there's some, and once I knew it was Carlos, there's certain things about it that sound like a guitarist, but the actual line itself is so George Martin. It's theory wise, it's from exactly the same school as Heroes, as the Heroes
really?
Bassline. Yeah. It's that same.
Oh,
sort of
I see
thing.
What you mean now. Yes, I'm thinking. Tony Visconti overdubbed the bass on that.
On what?
On Boys Keep Swinging.
Ah, well, that would. Again, well, that would make sense. But again,
I'm not 100%, but I read somewhere that, yeah, they all tried this thing of swapping instruments around. Visconti, obviously being a bass player himself.
Yeah, exactly. That would make sense because there's that run, there's that fill, that run down at the end of it, which is because you can always, yeah, which sounds like a bass player would do that, not because you can always tell, you always tell when guitarists play bass. Like, for instance, give David Gilmour a bass guitar and he will play the most pedestrian, nothing thing ever. Give him a fretless and he's David Gilmour again.
Really?
And he plays, if you listen to like Hey You off the Wall or something, there's this exquisite, languid kind of, because
that's
he sees
him play
it as
bass on Hey You.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's not going to be Roger, is it? Yeah.
Well. You were saying that this is an album that really wraps up the so-called trilogy. It's an album that's transitional. You know, what I think is interesting about this is that compared to the previous albums, this is Bowie actually quite human. He's gone back to a more rock-based sound after the electronica of the last few albums. He's gone to more, I don't know if you can call it traditional, but certainly there are more song-based structures. Do you know what I mean? Do you think
also, bear in mind, yes, there is. But there's also, I think there's an interesting cultural point, which is that this is his first album post-punk, right? Mm. This is, because it was Heroes before, wasn't it, in 77?
Yeah.
It's right in the middle of it. This is post-punk. And you've got to remember, right, for certainly for my generation, the only two people who came through punk unscathed were Bowie and The Who. They were the only two people who were like, absolutely, you know, you didn't have to defend at all. Roxy Music had broken up. I think they probably would have made it. Brian Bride Strip Bear, which stiffed, which he put down to punk.
How about the Stones with Some Girls?
Yeah, it was good, but the Stones were an absolute, you know, they were jet set trash. Right. You know, they personified, you know, they were, I mean, yes, you loved the Stones, but you kept quiet about it.
Like Pink, exactly. Yeah.
Which is ironic. The great thing is when you look back in time, in fact, Animals is actually as in keeping with the times as it could be. I mean, it's practically given them enough rope. But that's why I mentioned before, like on Yassassin, for instance, the fact that I was wondering because of the reggae thing, it's, because travel is so much the theme of the album and it's got the Turkish thing, but I wonder because that chord change, that flamenco Turkish, it's basically say E to F thing, is something that we had become, all the two-tone acts did. Hadn't been sort of in any way prevalent in pop music at all until the two-tone thing. So then I'm just wondering if he was referencing that or if he'd recorded it before, so...
To me, this album is really steeped in, say, more New York punk, right? So I think you've got a lot of Talking Heads in here, for example.
Yes.
You know, so yeah. I think
because Eno was steeped in all that long before.
Of course,
so
yeah. Been, yeah. You
know, so, yeah.
Well,
Eno was obsessed with Talking Heads, wasn't he?
Well, had Eno worked with them at this point, or was that yet to come?
Yeah, he would have. No, but remember early on, he wrote that song, King's Lead Hat, which was meant to be what Talking Heads would sound like if he produced them.
Right, yes.
I think he'd been in touch with them since like 76, 77.
So he'd been in with the Talking Heads for quite a while
now.
And I think,
and television, although that didn't work out, apparently. Eno had done something with Verlaine, Tom Verlaine.
Really? I didn't know that. Mm. With Lodger, we'll start off with Fantastic Voyage. And last time we spoke, we were kind of... going around this one a little bit, sort of trying to figure out where he was coming from. What was your take on that?
Well, I said I now have real trouble listening to it without hearing Boys Keep Swinging because it's the same it's the same song. Well, yes, because it's very much about him, isn't it? It was about him trying to get away from... It was about getting out of Berlin, really, isn't it?
It's about getting out of Berlin, but I mean, I think, you know, it could be a Fantastic Voyage's life itself. Life is this Fantastic Voyage. And here he is, kind of setting up this concept of himself as the traveller. And in so many ways, the more I think about it, this album is a departure. It's like Hegira by Joni Mitchell or something, you know, like the idea of travel is fundamental.
Yes. Oh, also, yes, and there's the Cold War worry, isn't there?
Mm, yeah, bombs and nuclear, you know, potential nuclear Armageddon and, you know...
Yeah, which, of course, you know, coming from Berlin, where that was, you know, you were, that was right on top of you every day. Why the move to Switzerland? I guess it's a sort of search for, perhaps a search for safety, the great neutral
zone. I think it's a search for safety from the tax authorities, to be honest.
Oh, really?
I think it was, well, I remember Robert, pretty much what it is.
Robert Palmer told me that when he moved there, the thing is that you do a deal with the tax authorities. He said the things you move there when you have a not particularly good year, and you say, look, this is what I made, and then you pay them that every year.
Really?
Yeah.
Blimey.
I don't know. I don't want to get into the intricacies of tax law with
it. No, me not, definitely. But at one point,
because I remember when he signed with the EMI, I remember there was a big thing about, wow, man, he's so hot with his business. You know, apparently he insisted that he got his advance in Swiss francs. And people are like, wow, it's a whoa. And it's like, well, no, he lived in Switzerland.
What a bastard. Obviously. How could he get his...
He just wanted to put it into his bank account.
but surely when Bowie signed to EMI, there must have been a lot of blowback from the left field, from the alternative side, about their man now showing up with this, you know, yellow blancmange on his head and the 50s zoot suits and Let's Dance and Nile Rodgers.
I don't, because as I said in my book, I loved it when that happened. Because when Let's Dance came out, it was like, because there were those of us, you know, musicians who'd all been completely bewitched by disco, and the whole thing that everyone had moved from rock music to funk and disco and stuff and hip hop, you know, because this is the early days of hip hop. So suddenly Bowie turns up with, you know, like a sort of punky version of a Chic record. It was like, fucking get in, mate. This ticks every box. It's New York. It's, you know.
Guy, so, I think this is the moment you tell us your Bowie story.
83, yes, that's, well, when I was in Ice House and we got asked to support him on the Serious Moonlight tour. And we were asked, we had that hit, Hey Little Girl.
Yeah.
And because it came quite late, it wasn't long before the tour, we got asked to do it. And so the band put together this, cause it was only three shows, we just did Milton Keynes and Rotterdam and Murrayfield. And so they put together this package, because that's come from Australia, where we did all these European festivals, these German festivals, with this German travelling festival called Midsummer Night's Dream. And Bowie came to see us. He came to see us. I was in catering and all these flashbulbs going off. And suddenly I was fucking hell, it's Bowie. And he just walked up and there were all these photographers. And he said, I think you should be in this. And I was just like, what? I'm standing there. And then Tony Thompson. He's with Tony Thompson and Carmine Rojas, and they put their arms around me, and I'm just like, what? And I pointed to myself in somewhat sort of, and I look ridiculous. I mean, the joke I made was that I'm in the photo, I'm wearing this sort of incredulous expression, and because it's 1983, my girlfriend's fucking kimono. So I look ridiculous. I think my flies are undone as well. And so I got the mental image of a
young Guy Pratt in a kimono, flies undone, with a goofy expression standing next to David Bowie.
A sleeveless denim jacket.
That's why he gravitated directly to you, isn't it?
But it was quite funny, because the record company had been desperately trying to get a picture of Bowie with Ivor, the singer from Ice House, for days. Ivor didn't speak to me for days. I didn't even want to be there, you know. The follow-up to this story is that in 2006, when Bowie came and sang with us with Gilmore at the Albert Hall, we did the sort of team photo of the band, all the special guests, and David, which is great, actually, because on the album, it's brilliant. It looks like it's my band and David Gilmour is Robert Wyatt's nurse.
He's standing behind his chair.
Yeah, he's holding behind his wheelchair and I'm in the middle, hey. And anyway, so when we did the picture, it was Brian Racic doing the picture. So I said, Brian, I was writing my book. So I want to try and get a picture with Bo. Do you mind? I went, yeah, sure. And I went up to David and said, hi, David, I'm really sorry, but I want to try and recreate this picture that you won't remember, but we had this picture taken in 1983. And he went, all right. And he stood next to me and I did the same thing, pointed to myself. And he went, I remember that picture. No, you don't, son of. He went, yeah, Ice House, Germany, 1983.
Wow.
You're kidding. It went, I was wearing this scarf. I thought, fuck, you know what? I think there was some haberdashery involved. I rushed back to get the photo, well, from my mum's, obviously. And bollocks, wasn't wearing a scarf at all.
What a charmer he was.
He was an absolute charmer.
I bet he was. Did you meet him again? In between?
Yeah. I had a night out with him. I had a night out with him and the band. For some reason, I just went down to the hotel bar at the right time in Rotterdam. But of course, I was just all over Tony Thompson because I was such a cheat nut. Yeah. And he just wanted to talk about John Bonham. And I was like, what? And so anyway, there was car. And then suddenly it was like, hey, we're going out. Come on. And I was like, what? And before I know it, I'm in the van. And then we're at this club with David. And I got to have a chat with David. Then it all goes mad. All these fans start trying to grab him. Someone got their hand around his throat. And David had to leave. And apparently they talked about this for years afterwards, apparently. It was quite a
so that wasn't
thing.
Just another ordinary night out with Bowie.
No, apparently really that was quite a big one, yeah. Although, like I said, when I stayed, and that's when Carlos Alomar, who was a font of real wisdom, who, you know, he said, yeah, going out with David's fine. You just got to let him leave. It was also on that tour that Carlos Alomar said, gave me this great advice, which I never fucking heeded. Which is so true, which is said at the end of any tour, just go on holiday or vacation. Oh. Obviously, he said, go on vacation. He said, don't go home. You're no good to anyone for weeks. And that's he's so advice. Right. Yeah. And I never took it because that's true. Because you just go. Yeah. I totally see the because I just finish a tour and I go home, bounce off the wall. So come on, what's happening? You know.
8 o'clock, the family sitting down to dinner and you're on the table going, hello, Wembley.
Yeah, who's holding? Oh, but the other, you know, the fantastic moment I had was when we were playing at Milton Keynes and my mum came backstage. I brought her backstage. And the funny thing was, and we had this porter cabin and the band, of course, being Australian, were a bit behind the curve. So they'd only just discovered cocaine. So it was a fucking mess in there. I didn't want my mum going in and
bunch
seeing
of
a load of
Australians taking
bunch of Australians pinned
time.
To the ceiling, which was my fault, to be fair. And so I just kept her outside, and we were just having a chat right in the grass. And it was one of those brilliant things where this limo just suddenly goes, pulls up right in front of us. Door opens, out gets Bowie. Hello, guy. Shakes my hand. Oh, David, hi. This is Tessa, my mum. Hi, Tessa. It's like, come on!
Oh, my God. What timing. What amazing timing. And I mean, I'm guessing that your mum knew who he was, obviously.
Of course,
if it was my mum,
it'd
be like, who's that? Who's that little man?
Oh, yeah. No. Mum's here. Well, the joke I used to have was that how the Australian part of any tour was always great because you did all sorts of fabulous, fun, healthy, outdoorsy things just because they make all their drugs in a wok and there's and there's nothing you want.
Well, let's move back from 1983 then back to African Night Flight.
African Night Flight, yes, which I love this thing. I've went and looked it up a bit. This bit about him meeting all these German pilots, German bush pilots.
Yeah, that's exactly what he's doing. And I'm going to include a little clip here now where he's talking about this song. And that's exactly what he's saying. He was on safari in Kenya. He'd go and hang out in these bars and there'd be all these former fighter pilots who are now doing tourist holidays and always drunkenly every night just going, one of these days I'm going to go back home. But it's kind of like, you know, the Japanese soldiers who would be in the forests for decades, you know. But stylistically, it's amazing, isn't it?
It's very My Life in the Bush of Ghosts.
Right, exactly. He's tumbling over the words, you know, he's just...
The dollar went down. All that stuff is brilliant. I love that.
Well, again, he was always very fond. I believe he was fond of...
That's very Eno as well, isn't it? Oh, do you know, can I make a point, though?
Yeah.
Which is maybe controversial. Which is that once he split with Mick Ronson, he never wrote a musically complex song again.
Oh.
In terms of technically complex, in terms of, if you look at, you know, a lot of the stuff, up to Aladdin Sane, stuff like Life on Mars is so complicated. It's got so many chords in it. After that period, he never wrote a song with more than, say, 6-7 chords in it.
Interesting.
So
I've never
wondered how much of that, how much of that was Ronson. Bowie, I mean, Eno was obviously super minimalist, chord-wise, but left to his own device. I mean, not to disparage his writing in any way, you know, an awful lot of his best songs were written there, but they were never complicated again, never musically complex.
Which ones do you think come close, then, in terms of complexity and sort of dynamics?
I can't think of any. There's none. I mean,
really? From after Aladdin Sane up to Black
After
Star.
Aladdin Sane, yeah. The last time, I mean, there's a couple of things like Sweet Thing on Diamond Dogs. There's a couple of things on Sweet Thing. But things like the chord sequence at the end of Rock and Roll Suicide, which is stunning. And so, and it's one of those things, it's not until you learn to play, you go, oh my God, what's going on here? And he never did anything like that again.
But that would have been Ronson, surely, wouldn't it?
That's what I mean. It's very interesting how important Ronson was for the, you know, just for the sheer technical musical. I'm not saying that anything was superior musically.
There was a great little clip on BBC a few years back where they had Rick Wakeman demonstrating Life on Mars.
Listen, my son did it for his grade 6 piano.
Really?
Yeah, he learned Rick Wakeman's part.
That must be tough. That must be really tough because Wakeman was saying, listen to this, what he's doing here. He goes here and then you expect it to go there, but it doesn't. It goes here and then it goes there. And he was marvelling at just the unorthodox arrangement and just how that served the dynamic of that song so beautifully. And it really, I can tell that there's, you know, unpredictable moments coming up. And it's like what the Beatles used to do, like any wonderful, extraordinary composer can do.
Have you seen Gary Kemp's Mick Ronson documentary?
No.
Where he gets a classical conductor and he gets a string section in to take you through Mick Ronson's string part for Life on Mars. And it's extraordinary.
I haven't seen that. Is he playing with Tony Visconti's band, Holy Holy? Is he singing?
No, he's singing with me, with Nick Mason's Sourceful of Secrets.
Getting all my tribute bands mixed up. Who's singing with Holy Holy?
I don't know. I don't fucking know.
I know.
I know the Bowie story I've got to tell you. You know when they did that thing at the Brits the other year where they did the tribute to Bowie?
Yeah.
And they had his band.
Lord.
Yeah. I was the bass player right the way up to the performance. I did all the rehearsals. I was with the band when they went to do that dinner for the documentary. I did the sound check. I did everything. And then Gail Andalsey turned up for the show. I had to stand in for that. And do you know what's really ironic at the time? At the time, David Gilmour, we were sort of between legs of his tour. And he decided he wanted to get a new band because he had a Bowie moment. And I was at that point, I was sacked. And I was cool with that. I was like, if David, it's up to you. If you want to get someone out, I totally get it. Even though I'd done nothing wrong. And he'd asked Gail Andalsey. And she was deciding whether or not to do it. And I was standing in for it. And the funny thing is, I was thinking, you know what? If I was her, if I was about to take someone's gig they've had for 28 years, I'd maybe let them fucking do this other one.
Yeah. Did she do it? I mean, did she?
No, she didn't. No, David got me back. Very funny thing. All the women in my life, are always right. My mum and my missus just went, he hasn't sacked you. I went, no, he has. He's getting someone. No, he isn't. He hasn't. No, he isn't. And true enough, he called me back.
Yes. So you basically rehearsed the band, you filled in for
them. Yeah, it was. I mean, it was heaven. It was great. I got on fantastically well with them. Apparently, Mike Garson speaks very fondly of me since then, which I'm very chuffed about.
Oh, he's amazing.
Yeah,
he's such an amazing player. But there was never any question then that you would have been doing that gig at the Brits. It was always that you were there.
No. It was always on the understanding that I was. Yeah, and obviously, I've never wanted someone's plane to be late. Mm. So much in my life. Yeah, she just made it the last minute. But I did get a goodie bag. So
what's in the goodie bag?
Oh, it was great. It was everything went to my son. A nice pair of headphones, a sort of waterproof set of speakers, you know, JBL stuff. It's very nice.
So when you were rehearsing with this band, I mean, do you have a favourite Bowie track to play? One that's just so
good to play? The thing had originally been 5 minutes and it got tucked down to about 90 seconds. So we were literally doing like 30 seconds of each song. It's like, oh, come on.
Oh, it was that kind of whole Stars on 45 thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, really. And it was, which was awful to do. I did realise afterwards I made a real rookie error in that I was playing under pressure an octave too low. It's ding, 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 ding. And I was playing ding, 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 ding. No, I'm a fucking bass player. What do you expect?
On that track of all tracks where it's the bass, where it's that hook.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it didn't occur to me that it was. It's a common mistake. I have octave blindness sometimes.
Mm. Any more thoughts on African Night Flight, yes. Or are we going to go straight?
No, not really. I mean, just it's like I said, it's my life in the bush of ghosts.
Right. So that's the Eno that, coming, really. The Eno, the David Byrne, all really coming.
I guess.
Swahili in the middle. And
yeah, what's that saying?
I've got it written
what's
down.
What's that saying?
I've got it written
or is it made
down.
Up? Yes.
It says.
It's Asante Habari Habari Habari, Asante Nabana Nabana Nabana.
And but
does it mean something or is it nonsense?
It does, but then I didn't write it down, so I don't know. I don't know. But one thing I do know is that Brian Eno is credited with Cricket Menace, Have you ever seen that?
It is.
And Cricket Menace is apparently the sound he made blending a fucked up drum machine and synthesizer for that gzz, gzz, gzz noise after the chorus. So there you go. There's a fact of the day. Right then, let's move on with Move On. God, I should be on local radio.
Move on. Now, Move On. Now, is this the one that was Guy Mitchell inspired?
No, that was Fantastic Voyage, which...
That was fantastic.
Yeah, I forgot to mention it this time, but yes, just to bring in that story. So Guy Mitchell, who sang She Wears Red Feathers and a Hula Skirt.
That's right. Now you said you thought the chords might have something to do with it. And I haven't looked up that song. I don't think it is. But like I said, but I am partly named Guy because of Guy Mitchell. So
that's wonderful. I don't know who I'm named after, but it's certainly not as cool as that. But it's actually Bowie who said that, because in an interview he said the song structure, Fantastic Voyage, I mean, not She Wears Red Feathers, appeared on the album Lodger in two forms. First, as it appears here, and then further, as Boys Keep Swinging.
No. That's right, yes, yes, that's right.
Both the tempo and the top-line melody are rewritten. I did this again on the album Scary Monsters. It proved nothing. Thinking about it, Guy Mitchell would have done this song proud.
That's right, yeah, no, I read that as well. Yeah, funny. Yeah, the other people who did that were Stock Aitken and Waterman, wasn't it? There's another track on the Rick Astley album, which is the same backing track as Never Gonna Give You Up.
Really?
Yeah, they use the whole backing track.
Right. Yeah. So Move On.
Move On. Another one, which I think, like I said, it's that same sort of irony thing of the way, it's got that very macho. It's very redolent of the Wanderer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Isn't it? Or I'm wondering if there's a bit of like Eric Burdon, you know, of we got to get out of this place.
You see, you say that. I can't quite hear that.
I know what you mean. I can appreciate that that's a perhaps rather tenuous link, but it says it to me. But it has got that very early 60s feel to it. And I do love it. I love the lyrics, and especially when you start listing places. It's brilliant.
Can you sort of expand on that 60s vibe that you're getting off it?
Yeah, well, just it's the fact that just those opening lines and the musical feel of it sounds quite sort of early 60s.
It's quite grandiose, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's quite, I mean, the sound-wise, it's quite garagey.
Yeah.
You know.
But even with that, those big guitar chords, ding, 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 and there's this sort of like the galloping toms all the way through, which I really love.
But that's the thing. It's that kind of, that's very surfy, isn't it? That's
exactly.
Very early, so ding, ding, ding.
And he's doing this this voice, kind of hamming it up a little bit as a square jawed 50s action hero. Somewhere, someone's calling me.
Yeah, exactly.
When the chips are down, you can hear the irony in it.
That's what I mean. That it is that same ironic thing, and it's with a sort of and it's slightly pastiche, I think.
Yeah, I mean, definitely here again. I mean, I think every one of these podcasts I've done, at some point, we have to mention Scott Walker, and I think
absolutely. I think that's the one thing I've been missing out. You're right. Yes, what a big part Scott Walker has to.
He definitely
that, and of course Anthony Newley.
Well, the two cornerstones of the Bowie voice or the Bowie vocal range, aren't they? Is Anthony Newley and Scott Walker. So,
although all people would say Syd Barrett.
Yes, and in this one of the interviews I saw last night, well, actually this Capital Radio thing, one of the students said to him, "What is it you do when you do this strange or dies voice?" And he goes, "Oh, well, that's Syd." Totally, 100%. That's it.
You know,
he directly ascribes that to Syd. Bowie is very, very determinedly doing his eyes in that sort of strangled London voice. So, that's definitely Syd. So Syd, the holy trinity of Syd, Anthony Newley and Scott Walker.
Syd, Anthony Newley and Scott Walker, Who was it? It was back in the early 80s. There was some impressionist, I can't remember who it was, who did a Bowie thing, which I never actually heard the original, but a friend of mine, Andy Kane, who's a brilliant singer, who's actually one of the biggest Bowie obsessive I've ever known, and he used to do this thing which I thought was really funny. All I can remember is his impersonation of it, which was, "Who's got my sausages? Oh. It's that fat Italian bastard on his motor scooter, got him hanging from his ears."
Oh, I know this. No. I know this.
And here's David Bowie singing his new single called "Where's My Sausages."
Where's my sausages?
Where I put them yesterday. Oh, yeah. Zigga, zigga, zigga.
Dogs and rabbits. funny little fluffy bits. Oh, little fat Italian on a motored scooter. He had my sausages hanging off his ears.
Have you heard Adam Buxton's Bowie thing?
No.
Oh, I've got to send you that. You'll love that. He's done a whole documentary using Lego men, like a stop-motion animated Lego thing.
Oh, no, I have seen it. Not the one with the Aladdin Sane cover and everything.
There's one where he comes home to Angie and he's like,
yes.
Angie, I've got an amazing idea. I'm going to yes. create a new character and call him Cobbler Bub. She's like, Cobbler Bob.
Yeah, no, that, oh, I've seen that one. I love that one. Yeah, it's got a drop of something. Yeah, that's, yeah.
That is fantastic. It's so good.
Count Jismark.
Count Jismark. And then he does another one as well, which is an animation of Visconti, Eno and Bowie recording Low.
Oh, no, I've seen that. That is brilliant. Tony Visconti doing a lot more than people might think.
Okay, this is Tony Visconti producing
I'm
this record.
I'm in a giant cave full of bats. Yeah, juicing. That's right. Yeah, anyway, yeah.
So that was Move On. We then come on to the track we've already mentioned, which is Yassassin. And obviously Bowie living in Berlin, yes. living near Kreuzberg, where there was a huge Turkish population.
Very, very Turkish, yes.
Very Turkish population.
I said, having been there, Gary Kemp and I made a pilgrimage to the flat.
Oh, really?
When we were... Yeah, yeah. We stayed in this hotel just up the road when we played there summer before last. And so, yeah, Gary and I made a pilgrimage up there. In fact, that's my Facebook profile, is a picture of me and Gary outside that flat. And... And I thought, this is a great thing. Yaron Stavi, the great bass player, said, oh, I lived there. I was like, really? Yeah, I lived there for 3 years. You didn't know? No, I never knew Bowie lived there.
You didn't
there. Know? Like, mate, you don't... No, you didn't know. I was like, mate, did you not fucking notice when you went to the coffee shop, which is just a shrine to Bowie and Iggy? Every shop has got... It's just Bowie. It, you know, you'd be thinking something must have been going on. In 2004, just after The Next Day came out, I had this brilliant thing. I was in Berlin... on tour with Brian Ferry, yeah. and Brian was cancelling shows left, right, and centre that tour. So we and my then girlfriend, now fiance, Georgie, had just flown out, and the gig got cancelled. But we were there, and they couldn't cancel a hotel or anything. So we basically just had a paid city break in Berlin. And so we had a thing of trying to go to everywhere mentioned in the lyrics.
Oh no way!
Of where are
you
we
took
now?
The train to Potsdamer Platz, and.
Yep, and we went to Cardaway, and I'd never been to Cardaway, and fucking
it's
hell,
amazing,
man, that food hall,
yeah.
for someone as thin as Bowie, it must have been a nightmare.
I don't know how he did it. He was talking about going there with Coco and treating themselves to caviar, oysters and all that lot, coming back and then Iggy literally wiping the fridge out and there would be a big fight later on from the food hall. And again, it's just... unbelievable, the fact that... And Cardaway, the food hall, is just a thing of beauty. Even when
it's insane.
When the wall was up.
I mean, it's insane. Yeah. It makes Harvey Nicks look like Lidl.
Oh, I miss that place so much. It was such a wonderful place. And that was the first part of our Lodger chat with Guy Pratt. And we'll have much more where that came from very soon. And in the meantime, if you made it this far, thank you. And I really do hope you enjoyed it. Please don't forget to share and review this podcast if you did enjoy it. And you can, of course, always comment over at Album to Album on Twitter or on Facebook if you like, because it's really nice to get the feedback and thoughts from everyone, so do feel free. So till next time, stay well, stay safe, stay sane, and we'll be back very soon. Thanks and bye for now.